back to Geeks at College, and we're at the very start of our Emmys coverage. The Emmys sucked this year. Moving on.
End of Emmys coverage.
End of Emmys conversation. Actually, here's a little tangent or little segue. Stephen Moffat won for Sherlock, and this episode we're talking about the return of Doctor Who.
Well, I did not see that coming. Got it? Because Stephen Moffat has ruined Doctor Who, and thus is a Nazi.
Thanks for that. Yes, so we're going to start this episode. We're going to have two big TV reviews. One, a show ending, which is Korra, which is going to be in the next part. And Doctor Who returning with Peter Capaldi as the 12th Doctor. So I guess we'll just start on that right away, Casey.
All right.
Do you want to start us off with talking about Deep Breath?
Okay, Deep Breath. Hold on, I just need to take a deep breath.
Oh my god, Casey, just get on with it.
No, if I had to talk about Deep Breath, I would like everybody... I feel like the perfect thing that needs to happen is everybody to go to YouTube and bring up the Rolling Stones song, Mixed Emotions.
For you, anyway.
Yeah, I feel like everybody's... also divided. Fine. YouTube, a house divided, and see what happens.
Yeah.
Because it's clearly divided everyone else, and I'm mixed. But it's the first episode with Peter Capaldi, and it starts off with a weird, possibly animatronic, possibly CG, giant dinosaur walking around Victorian-era London. And the Doctor... And it coughs up the TARDIS, and the Doctor walks out of it, and... says things in a very thick Scottish accent while also mumbling, so I couldn't tell what the fuck he was saying. and then Jenna Coleman's sad.
This is the first official episode.
And if it sounds like I am not focused at all when I say that, God knows I'm more focused than they were for the first half of this episode.
Well, first off, we should state that this episode was actually an extended one. It's like, I think... Yeah. What was it, like 70 minutes, I think?
It was 1 hour and 45 minutes with commercials.
Well, with commercials, but take away how many minutes of commercials, and you got, like, what, 90 minutes? If not more, like...
80 minutes.
75, yeah.
I'd say 75 to 80 minutes, but either way...
It's longer than it needs to be.
Yeah.
Like, you could probably make it, like an hour without commercials, and you're...
I feel like you could have made it an hour with commercials and you would have been just fine, actually.
Or 45 minutes, so a regular episode.
Yeah, this could have been a regular episode. It did not need
to be... Was the 11th hour a regular episode?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, well, I don't know. I think part of that is because... I mean, I don't think it was a good decision, necessarily, but I think it was because when the 11th hour started, that's back when Doctor Who was still... kind of a, like, more underground cult show, and now that it's exploded so much...
Well, it was getting really big in Britain, but since then, it's also gotten big in America. Doctor Who is a worldwide phenomenon. And bear in mind, I work at a clothing store in upstate New York, but I will say to people something along the lines of, like, if I'm trying to tell people about bow ties, and I would say, well, your son is tall and skinny, so he can get away with wearing a bow tie. They're the people who can pull it off. I call it the Doctor Who effect. They'll know what the fuck I'm talking about when I say the Doctor Who effect.
Well, yeah, this is a show that had, like, the largest simulcast of an episode of, like, around the world, which I think was Day of the Doctor last year, which is a similar kind of thing where it's, like, a movie-length special.
Yeah, and the show also has some really weird celebrity fans. Like, what's the name of that woman who was on the Today Show with Matt Lauer?
Be more specific.
The one who left to do afternoon TV, pretty much.
That doesn't even...
All right, either way, Katie Couric.
It's a Katie Couric.
Yeah, Katie Couric is a huge Doctor Who fan.
Yeah.
And I forget if it's Glenn Close or Helen Mirren. Honestly, they're interchangeable in my mind.
Well, it's like now we have shit like, you know, Chris Hardwick has these shows like on the Nerdist where he talks about Doctor Who and like it's a big panel thing. Like they're talking about a show like Breaking Bad or The Walking Dead, you know?
Yeah, it's like the show has, despite how fucking silly it is, become very legitimized.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a thing. It's becoming a phenomenon, and I feel like they're trying to make too many event episodes of Doctor Who as a result.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost, if you can pardon the equivalency here, look at what Nickelodeon was doing with iCarly and how
I'm going to stay with you on this one.
All right. The way that, for some reason, they decided at a point, yeah, we're not going to do seasons. We're just going to wait 2 months between episodes, and then when we aired them, it'll be an event episode.
Which is essentially 3 episodes of iCarly
put together. They did that for, like, an entire season, man.
Yeah, I know. It's like that season of Doctor Who where they did the specials. Well, it's not a season, but, like, you know, they had those bunch of...
Yeah, but the thing is, they did this for an entire season, is what I'm saying. Like, 13 episodes. They would wait, like, 6 weeks to 2 months and then air them.
Yeah. Nickelodeon. Yeah. No wonder Koro moved to online only.
But that's another thing. But for some reason, Doctor Who is doing the exact same thing. And it's like, oh my god, why are you doing this? And thankfully, I'm glad that we're apparently moving on to just a regular season now. I think, is there going to be a new one this Sunday?
Yeah, it's Into the Dalek or whatever it's called. Which is the best title. Didn't that happen in season 7? Waka waka waka, Clara. Allswin.
Into the
Dalek. Yeah, it's Into the Dalek.
Out of the Dalek. Into the Dalek.
That's what... Look, Clara, we're in the Dalek.
Dun, 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 I love dun. You, buddy.
But yeah, next episode's called Into the Dalek, and it's a regular 45-minute episode.
I'm glad that we're just going to a regular season at this point.
Well, even with what we were talking about, that whole extended thing would either be... you know, usually reserved for specials like Day of the Doctor or Time of the Doctor or something. Like, it makes, in a sense, it makes sense for this because it's the reveal of the next Doctor. But the screenplay doesn't really fit with what... It's basically a 45-minute screenplay stretched.
Yeah, because the script does not have that much going on. In the first half of the episode, it's meandering, it's out of focus, it doesn't really know what it wants to do. It's kind of derivative of Tenet's debut episode, honestly.
There are
some very striking similarities, which are very disappointing, because Tenet's first episode isn't good.
No, it's not. I like this episode better.
Yeah, oh, it's better than that one, but that's...
It's actually, a low bar.
I think it's a little bit better, but not by a lot.
I don't know. I like it a little bit better because there's characterization problems with both, but I feel like the ones for Capaldi are, like, for, you know, since we don't know his character as much, they feel more gradual than in The Christmas Invasion, where, you know, David Tennant's Doctor, who has been on screen for... what, 20 minutes, and then basically fucks over the entire career of a former ally of his.
Yep.
It's like that, in a sense, that's really...
Oh, that is worse. It sucks. It is completely awful. I'm surprised people don't give Davey shit for writing like that.
Oh, yeah. I think people are starting to now. Like, here's the thing. Like, I guess we could use this thing that we're... this recording here about... deep breath to talk a bit about our feelings on Moffat. Like, I know we've talked about him probably... Emmy award-winning Stephen Moffat, as take that however you will. Casey, what are your thoughts on Stephen Moffat's run on the show versus Russell T. Davies?
I think that Stephen Moffat understands character... one finger of Stephen Moffat's hand understands characterization, plot, and pacing, and quick wit without being obnoxious better than the entirety of Russell T. Davies' body. And Russell T. Davies is not an awful writer, per se. He's like a 4 out of 10. But...
my God. All right.
But he would be embellished. He gets indulgent in things that he likes, and you'll see a lot of the same tropes. And you can say that about every writer. Oh, my stuff, you get a lot of things about people who fear death and coming to terms with their own impending demise. Mm-hmm. Like, when you read my stuff, there's a lot of that, because that's stuff that interests me. But with Russell T Davies, it becomes very obvious very quickly, and it gets crowbarred in. If you look, I would say 80% of episodes that are titled by Russell T Davies have a character heroically sacrificing themselves at one point. Sometimes they do a really good job building up to it. Sometimes he will knock four times.
So, yeah.
And whereas Stephen Moffat, yeah, he understands characterization a lot better. He can have characters who it's clear he really likes writing them, without it just being the show about them. Like Russell T. Davies first admits, he fell in love with the character of Rose. And
no way! Shut up!
And falling in love with the character you create is the best thing you can do and the worst thing you can do.
Because one of the biggest things to know about writing, don't let a good character, a character you love, get in the way of a good story.
Yeah, well, it just gets down to you need to actually care about it. Otherwise, you're just not going to give a shit, and it's going to show when you write it.
Yeah.
But you also need to be able to look away, and just because you love this character doesn't mean that you need to have a scene where Rose runs off with a clone of the Doctor while the real Doctor watches. AKA the only moment of Journey's End that isn't awesome. But that's just clearly a thing where, I mean, look at the Russell T Davies era. It's about Rose. Even in the season where she doesn't appear, it's about her.
Yeah, that's the Martha season. What season is that?
Martha season. It's all three. About... Yeah, it's about the Doctor getting over Rose.
And poor Martha, who could have been Martha. a cool character, but she never really grows... Well, I think
season four... Yeah, Rose above. But season four... She is no longer in love with the Doctor. She's realizing, dude, you have, like, commitment problems up the wazoo. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go on my own adventures. And the few times that we ran into her since then, she is so much more interesting.
Yeah.
And this season, and it's clear when you're watching, say, Deep Breath, that Stephen Moffat really loves the 11th Doctor, and he really loves Clara. And I feel like... how he wrote, there's a problem with that when it comes to the 11th Doctor, and we'll get into that later. But how he wrote Clara in this episode is solidified. She is my favorite companion of the Moffat era.
Okay.
Like, I really love the fact that most of this episode, she's kind of turned against the Doctor for a while.
Yeah, I guess we should talk about that whole...
The Doctor's being a fucking prick to her.
Well, yeah, because I think that's one of the best... That's actually one of my favorite aspects of this episode, because it is a very meta episode, mm-hmm. in because we the viewer are going through essentially the same feelings that Clara is going through, which is we don't necessarily like this new Doctor. It isn't the Doctor we've, you know, known and loved for three seasons beforehand, and so there's definitely some growing pains, so to speak, with that. And I actually really commend the episode for that, because that's such a big thing in Doctor Who, just as a fandom, is just you. And I know a lot of people are like, I don't know how I feel about Peter Capaldi, and that's actually, I mean, that's kind of how it should be in a way, because when you're so used to one actor playing a character, mm-hmm. and then you just have they go, and then you have there's not a whole lot of, and you know, I know we give Russell T. Davies and Stephen Moffat kind of shit for their, you know, changing of hands.
Yep.
But that happens with most, like, recasting of the Doctor. It's just that's a really, really, I guess, exaggerated version where it's so clear that, wow, well, that is you really...
It's clear that a writer changed in the meantime, because most of the time the showrunner doesn't change when the writer changes.
Mean actor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And I really like that, you know, I know some people, I think, didn't like the fact that Clara didn't like that he was old now, but again, that's very meta, because there was kind of this whole period where, oh man, the Doctor isn't hot anymore from the fans. Like, the Doctor Who fangirls who really... And this is obviously not all Doctor Who fangirls, but a lot of them I remember seeing, like, oh, no, the Doctor isn't hot anymore. I'm not going to watch. So it's more or less just a critique of that. So that's what she goes through a lot of the episode, and a lot of it is her becoming used to the 12th Doctor and realizing that, in a sense, it is the same person, but just different aspects. Because, you know, the Doctor is the most... is kind of the biggest example of, like, schizophrenia. Because it's, like, one person, or, like, not schizophrenia, but, like, multiple personality syndrome, because... or dissociative identity disorder, or whatever it is.
You're just going through a psychology textbook, aren't you?
Nope, I'm looking at Children of Earth, Torchwood, Children of Earth, because I wanted to see if Russell T. Davies actually wrote some of that. And he did. Probably one of the better things he wrote. No, he didn't write all of it.
Oh.
No.
Oh.
Yeah, oh. But anyway. God, what was I even fucking saying? Anyway.
We were talking about how difficult it is to transfer doctors.
Yeah.
And it's – and you have to have them win it over. And I feel like the one of the best examples is with the 11th Hour, how they did that.
Yeah, the 11th Hour, like, it's really interesting because a lot of my watching Deep Breath, I was just thinking back to the 11th Hour. It's interesting what Moffat chose to emphasize in that special and not emphasize in this one, such as, like, the Doctor – getting his outfit, you know, because mm-hmm. in the 11th Hour, he's going through a hospital and, like, picking up pieces of clothes because he, you know,
how the 8th Doctor actually got his.
Yeah.
Which is weird because the 8th Doctor dresses like he's in Victorian times.
Yeah.
How the fuck did he get those out?
I don't fucking know, man.
Oh, yeah, because it was a New Year's costume party.
Oh.
For some reason.
Oh, yeah. God, I haven't watched that movie in a while. Okay.
Oh God, do you remember Eric Roberts in that movie?
Of course I fucking do. He's the best / worst part of that.
Eric Roberts as the Master.
Kind of amazing.
We need more of that.
We need more of that. I hope they bring back the Master at some point. That'd be cool.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of surprised they haven't at this point.
Yeah, I remember a theory and actually discussing. I think you was
Rory
it was like,
is the Master.
Yeah, Rory as the Master. That would have been a really cool storyline if you asked me.
It would have been a weird storyline, and I would have liked it more than say how they finally finish Rory, because a lot of season 6 they imply that there's shit going on with him now that he has he's lived like 1,000 years.
Yeah,
but they never really went anywhere with it at all.
Yeah.
And I really wish that they kind of did. Otherwise, because that's another thing I don't like about the Angels Take Manhattan, is that it's no longer – that episode isn't the Doctor's farewell to Amy and Rory. It's the Doctor's farewell to Amy. Oh, and I guess bye Rory too.
Oh, bye Rory. Yeah.
And especially because by that point you actually feel, oh, there is camaraderie between – the Doctor and Rory. It's not like they're friends in law or anything like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, hell, it's been kind of like that since most, like the later half of season 5. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I was just talking about, you know, the Doctor basically having multiple personalities. Like, the idea is that every Doctor represents kind of just a different side of that person. They should never be, like, the same person, necessarily. Mm-hmm. Or the same personality. But you can tell that they're kind of the same person, I guess you could say. Like, one could be more, like, you have the 9th Doctor, which is kind of more brooding in a bit, but, you know, he has his moments of happiness, too, and you can tell that he feels a lot of guilt. But then you have kind of the bubbly energy of 10, like, you know, the love of all life, and then you have the childlike nature of 11.
But you can see elements... of pretty much, with the exception of maybe William Hartnell, you can see elements of every Doctor in every other Doctor.
Yes, which is,
like,
I
even
think
the ones
thing.
That are radically different, like, say, Colin Baker, you get, you can still see, oh, Colin Baker liked Patrick Troughton or something like that.
Yeah. And well, it's like, I mean, Colin Baker's Doctor is known for kind of having a short fuse, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and Matt Smith's Doctor would have that at some points, too.
Yeah, there's that, and Peter Capaldi, especially watching this, I got weird flashbacks to Colin Baker's era, both in how he's portraying the Doctor and the fact that it kind of got dark.
It did kind of get dark. I mean, I know...
it's pretty fucking dark.
It gets pretty fucking dark, like...
like, like, we're used to Doctor Who being dark in a way of, say, Blink, where it's like, okay, this is dark, but it's not necessarily showing you things that you can't show kids, even if it would scare them a little. This is the first episode of the revival that I've looked at and go, should kids be watching this?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like it's abandoning the kid audience to a degree, which I'm not entirely okay with. Kids should be able to watch fucking Doctor Who, man.
Yeah, I guess we'll just have to see, because it's at this point, since it's really just our first, we're basically just dipping our toe into the Peter Capaldi pool here. Yeah. And we don't really have a clear idea of what he is. Who, for all we know, even though I know Stephen Moffat has said that it's going to be darker or whatever.
Yeah, well, I'm okay with it being darker, but I would almost say, like, take the hints of what was going on towards the end of 11 and go from there. But don't go where you went with this one. Like, it, no matter what, in these episodes, you have to have a light, a shining light of not dark.
Mm-hmm.
And Matt Smith's Doctor could be that. Even though he was admitting, I am not a good man, I have done bad things, etc., etc., he can still be a light of hope, a light of somebody trying to do the right things, of doing what needs to be done. And beyond that, the companion who can be the voice of reason, the person who keeps him from doing those things. And
which is kind of like, that's more of what's going on in this episode. To an extent.
Yeah, to an extent, but even then, it's what should be going on.
Yeah.
But he alienates Clara, which he's not just alienating her because he's regenerated. She knows about the regeneration. She's not surprised by that. For her, it's the fact that he you know, leaves her for dead.
Yeah, I think, I like this episode a little more than I think most people do, kind of in the minority. But I think that's something that definitely stuck out to me. And I think it could have been fixed with just a simple change of the script.
Yeah.
So basically what happens is, the Doctor and Clara, because they're in Victorian London, mm-hmm. and of course, Madame Vostra and Jenny and Strax are there. I mean, did you like them in this episode? Do you feel like they were unnecessary, or?
I think that I like pretty much most appearances they do. They're the right level of comedy, helping the Doctor and getting things done while still being interesting characters. I feel like they made Madame Vostra a little too flirty in this episode. It seemed a little out of character with what we've seen before. Yeah. Like just random inflections of, Clara, take off your clothes or something like that.
Take it off, bitch. Like yeah, well, whoa.
Well, no, it's like some of those were a little out of left field.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah, so that was stuff that I wasn't as on board with, but for the most part, I liked them in this episode.
I liked Strax in this episode. I like Jenny.
Yeah, Strax was great. Jenny was great. My only complaint, honestly, with them, besides the random, like, almost out of character flirtatiousness of Madame Vostra, is when Clara finally gives the code word to have them drop in and help them fight. I just thought, why the fuck didn't you do it like 5 minutes ago when you were left for dead?
Yeah.
Which is another issue with it. Like, that entire thing, I really appreciate it. Like, getting her in the position where she's on her own.
Yes. It's very similar to what's that? The season 5 episode with the Weeping Angels.
Good. I know the one you're talking about.
I know one of them's called The Time of Angels, and I think one's called Flesh and Stone.
Yeah, yeah, those are those.
Time but like you know the scene I'm talking about where Amy's by herself, and she has to keep her eyes closed,
mm-hmm.
and there's and it's basically the Doctor just talking to her through I think an earpiece or something. And it's a very similar situation to that, except the Doctor doesn't just kind of leave her there. Like, he does it in the first one because he's kind of reluctant, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, he doesn't want to leave her, but he needs to go, and he's like, you need to trust me. I'll be back. And, goes. And it's similar in this one, except the Doctor just kind of like, oh no, the door is closed between us. And, see a bitch.
But the, But well, that's just it. He says, like, she even asks, like, can I take the screwdriver? He's like, I might need it. And it's just like, oh, God. You fucking just left her to die if she can't figure her way out of there, man. Which, thankfully, she does. And that is the best scene of the episode, where Clara has to figure out a way to get out of that position. And just seeing her try to hold her breath for that long and seeing how she wants to cry as that is happening.
Yeah.
That was fucking amazing.
That was a great sequence. It just, I wish they just changed it so the doctor was basically just said, I'm going to look for a way to get you out of here.
Yeah. And they kind of did that at the end where she's like, and I know the doctor would never abandon me. And it turns out he didn't abandon her. But it just, the way that they set it up just seemed a little.
Because he comes and saves her anyway. Like, so it's like, why not just have it be, oh, I'm going to go find a way to get you out of here. I'll be right back.
Like, I get what they're going for. It's like she needs to feel like the doctor it needs to be she's put the test of, okay, the doctor abandoned me. Do I still trust the doctor? And her trust is rewarded. But the way that they did it, I think, was completely wrong. I think that it shouldn't have been an act of selfishness where he said that.
Yeah.
It should have been she's put in a situation where the doctor probably can't get her out. For, as far as they know, the doctor won't be able to do anything. But yet, she still trusts that the doctor would find a way to break the realms of logic and feasibility and find a way to get her out.
Yeah, you can even have it where, like, some door happens or something and they can't even hear each other or something like that. I don't know. How would you solve that problem?
I would make it be the doctor – and you can even have it be, say, the doctor runs the doctor and her realize they need to get out of a room, and the doctor runs out ahead of her, and the door closes, and she's stuck there. And she, at that point, she does feel a little abandoned by the doctor. But then the doctor turns around, he bangs on the door, he realizes Clara's still in there. She's taken, and she needs to find a way to get out of there. And when she's put to the test of, I believe the doctor's going to save me, that's when it still happens. She, even though she, there's no reason for her to believe that he'll be able to save her. The doctor pulls one of a miracle out of his ass and he fucking does it. I know that kind of sounds like a Deus Ex Machina, I describe it, but...
Well, Doctor Who is a show of Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah.
So, what did you think of Peter Capaldi's, performance in this episode?
I both really like him and I'm really frustrated by him. Because the thing is, a lot of the best scenes in him... With him, they almost feel like they're old Matt Smith scenes. But the way he's portraying them, his voice is deeper, it's a little more gravelly, it's a little more bitter, which didn't always work for the performance they're going for. It took the playfulness of how Matt Smith or David Tennant would deliver a line and made it sound like he had fucking Alzheimer's or dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like that, but at the same time, it was still interesting seeing him portray it. Like, it's not a bad performance objectively. It just has some really weird things, and I'm not sure how I feel about it yet. It's not as immediately welcoming as other performances of Doctor Who. His is a lot more disjointed, a lot more – it's a little rougher around the edges.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's going to get the hang of it.
So. Oh, yeah. I mean, every Doctor has to kind of grow into the role. I mean, Matt Smith did that. I think the only one that really didn't have to do that was probably Christopher Eccleston, because, you know, it had been so long in between Doctors that just kind of having this Doctor, you know,
I would say Paul McGann pretty much nailed it right off the top. But
oh, then, and Paul McGann too, but
then again, he had to.
He had to because he was in a movie. So, yeah. But I don't know. Like I'm kind of in the same boat because I both really enjoyed what he did. I think I'm just more excited for what they do rather than – I think that's where I leave this episode, is that while objectively it isn't the best, it's kind of all over the place. I do think people are right in saying that a lot of the problems come from the script. I think mm-hmm. people kind of over-exaggerate on how much of the problem the script is. because there are some people that are just like, oh, it's so bad. And it's like, it's not bad. There's parts that are just poor decisions. I don't think there's much problem in the setup. The villains are fine enough. I like, and again, there's aspects of the script that I think really work, like the whole allegory of Clara dealing with the regenerated doctor and not knowing really who he is, not recognizing him, and what the viewers are going through, basically going through the same thing. And I also liked the little subtle thing between the I forget what the half-faced man or whatever the villain's name is, the robot with people skin on him.
The other clockwork guy, which
yeah,
that is another thing I like. I like that there's this that there's these callbacks to the girl in the fireplace, but the doctor actually can't figure out. Oh God, where do I know this from?
Yeah, but as I was saying, I like this whole idea brought up about how this half-faced man keeps stealing people's skins and stealing people's faces. And he's changed so much that it's like, is he even himself anymore? And of course, that directly parallels what the doctor's going through.
Like, especially since he's saying, where did I get this face? And it's like, oh, you have been in this show before, Peter Capaldi.
Yeah, that's where I got it. The Fires of Pompeii. That episode kind of sucked. Anyway.
But it had its moments.
It had its moments. But again, volcano aliens.
One of them portrayed by Amy Pond.
Yes. God, that episode just had fucking everybody. Matt Smith played like the Greek prostitute.
Literally, the 11th through the 27th Doctor all appeared in that one.
As like Greek prostitutes. but I actually really appreciated that. I wish it was explored a little bit more, this whole idea of like the doctor and this guy basically being the same thing, but I like that it's in there. How did you feel about the whole, you know, one of us is lying scene?
The implication, you're talking about the fact that it's implied that the doctor might have pushed a guy to his death.
Yeah, but I mean, he was like a robot, kind of, so it doesn't count quite as much. I don't know.
And it's that scene is, it's supposed to set, it's what I'm going back to with, it's trying to set a darker tone for the season. But the thing is, it's not sure, I'm not sure it's right for this show. Stephen Moffat can write dark all he wants, but you don't necessarily need to just make something dark because you can make it dark. I love fucking, I don't know, what's something I love, Taylor?
I don't That's know.
Dark.
Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah, but Simon Garfunkel's dark.
Are they dark? Or are they not? What? Dude,
like every song is about, I'm Paul Simon and I'm sad.
There you go.
Garfunkel's making fun of me. He threw my guitar up on the roof where I can't get it.
He put it on top of my bunk bed where I can't get it.
He also took the ladder away. I tried to jump, but I could barely reach the bottom bunk. Either way, just because you can make something dark doesn't mean it should be dark. And I'm reminded of when I was 14 and wanted to make a dark, gritty reboot of Peter Pan.
Peter Pan X.
You're not far, I guarantee you're not far off.
Okay, so I guess we should talk a little bit more. Like, so are you more cautiously optimistic about Peter Capaldi,
They have enough going that even though I'm not sure if I'm with it, it still interests me enough that I want to keep going with it. I'm not going to just write him off altogether like people tend to do with new doctors who aren't.
Which is completely a stupid thing to do.
Yeah.
Because, like I said before, this is always going to happen as long as this show is going. You know, it's like having a dad. And then that dad leaves, and then the next day your mom has a new boyfriend, you know?
That is a really weird analogy.
I'm just saying. It's late. It's late, folks.
Yeah, it's like how I couldn't come up with something I liked that wasn't dark.
But, I mean, it's like basically having something that you love, and then having it taken away from you, and something take its place.
Yeah.
Basically. you could say for anything, like a new toy or whatever.
It's like when you get a PS3 instead of a PS2, and you initially go, the PS3 sucks.
Said in like 2007. Yep. but again, that's why Doctor Who fans always kind of need to have this sense of open-mindedness when going into a new Doctor and a new showrunner or whatever. Whenever there's a big major change in the show, mm-hmm. that's what needs to happen. I am totally game for what they're doing, even though this episode does have its fair share of problems. You want to talk a bit about Jenna Louise Coleman's turn? I mean, you already said that she's
this
now...
This is a fantastic performance by her.
Because she's more or less like, she is the protagonist of this episode, really. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily the Doctor, but go on.
Yeah, it's told through her eyes, and what she has to do throughout the episode is she's not guided by anything. She has to figure shit out on her own. She needs to find a way to find the Doctor again. She needs to deal with the fact that he's being a pompous twit, and uh-huh. she needs to figure out exactly how to get the. How to get everything going again. And at a point she thinks, yeah, I'm going to be stuck in Victorian England now.
Yeah.
But she finally figures things out, and she's able to find a doctor. She doesn't give up on him. He doesn't give up on her. And there's a point towards the end of this episode where she's wondering if she even wants to keep going with him. And she gets a call from Matt Smith's doctor. Which is another scene where I'm really mixed about.
What's the scene?
Where she gets a phone call and the 11th Doctor is on the other end.
Yeah, the second to last scene, pretty much.
Yeah, and he tells her, this guy, I can tell you, I've been there. This guy is scared. He's not sure what to do. He's not sure who he is yet, but he's going to need your help. He needs a familiar face.
And I like that aspect of the scene.
Yeah, well, I like that. I just feel like having Matt Smith again is something that's going to make the transition a little harder. If they just did it where it's Matt Smith's voice on the other end and you don't actually see his face, I feel like it would have gone so much smoother. Like, I would be so on board with that scene. It was just a phone call and you never see it, but you keep on cutting back to him on the other end. Mm-hmm. And while I appreciate what they're going for, like I said, just have it be audio only, it would have gone so much smoother.
What do you think it is? Is it just the fact that we see him and then the 12th yeah. Doctor?
Well, it's that we see him, and it makes the idea of we're going on to a new Doctor a little bit harder to swallow.
Okay.
And it's just keep cutting back to him. It's like, hey, remember there was this guy? Remember there was this guy? And it's not helping the transition as much as it thinks it is.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like part of me felt like I wish they didn't have it at all, only because I wanted kind of Matt Smith's last appearance to be that last scene.
Oh, that too. That was it.
But yeah,
this is a coda that doesn't need to be there.
But at the same time, I love that whole idea of like, this man is scared, and you need to be there for him and like understand.
It's objectively, it's a good scene that doesn't necessarily need to be there.
Yeah. I do like a lot of the ending, and I like, as the episode goes, I feel better about the relationship between the 12th Doctor and Clara. It's just kind of a shame that she's going to be gone after the season, correct?
That turned out to just be a rumor from a
really? Really?
Dude, that's just from a tabloid. I have not seen anyone else report on that.
Okay. I'm not sure. I have no idea. But if... Yeah, you fact-checked that. But I love the scene in the restaurant where they first meet up at the restaurant and they're just kind of going back and forth. And it's just kind of this friendly, you know, giving each other shit kind of relationship. Mm-hmm. Basically you and me, Casey.
Yeah.
I like the idea that the kind of flirtiness is gone between them, like they're just friends.
Oh, I like that a lot too.
Because that was kind of one of the confusing things about season 7. It was like, is Clara supposed to be a love interest thing? Because one of my favorite aspects about Stephen Moffat's run, for the most part, at least for the first two seasons,
is that he doesn't have love interest companions. things.
Well, except for River.
Yeah, well, River is reoccurring, but I.
But she's not. Yeah, she's not a regular. It's like that's what I love about, you know, Amy's choice. That's why Amy's choice could very well be my favorite episode of. Well, it's not maybe not my favorite of Moffat's run, but it's in like the top five at least. Because I love how it just kind of, it's almost like saying, like, the whole shit with Rose was kind of stupid, and we're just going to nip it in the bud, and that's why we have Rory. We're not going to have some, like, love triangle thing. And then they kind of keep reinforcing that, you know, you have when a good man goes to war, and you have Amy kind of giving this soliloquy to her newborn baby about, like, this man who's, like, 1,000 years old, and it's like, oh, she's talking about the doctor. No, she's talking about Rory. And it's awesome, you know? So, I'm glad that, because that was, again, it was kind of awkward, and just, I didn't understand it, in season 7 between the doctor and Clara.
Alright, so just, also, on that, it was originally reported by the Mirror.UK, which I love how this website puts it. It's this side of the pond's equivalent of the National Enquirer.
Oh, nice.
So she has been giving interviews where she's been a little tight-lipped, but it doesn't sound like it's just like, okay, I'm done after this season or anything like that.
Okay, because I would feel like that's really a sad thing because she basically has, like, a season and a half.
Yeah.
But I think this episode did a lot, like, improved Clara leaps and bounds.
All right, and Peter Capaldi also completely dismissed that rumor.
Okay, good. But anyway, as I was saying, I know a lot of people are very on the fence about Clara, but I think this episode helps greatly because one of her problems was that she just didn't have a whole lot to do. Like, we were said that she was important, but it just... Like, most of her arc was just kind of in the background and wasn't dealt with because season 7's whole mission statement was no season-long arcs that are convoluted.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was the antithesis of season 6, and it didn't necessarily work as well.
Yeah, because it's like, granted, The Name of the Doctor is a really good episode, and she plays a big part of that. It's just kind of, her aspect's kind of like, oh, so this is what they're talking about. This solves that question. But here it's like there's great characterization and great stuff like that where, you know, she has motivation for what she's doing and we get to see more of her and her feelings on the situation. And I really like that. And I really applaud them on that. And hopefully that continues going into the episodes. So, I guess Casey, quick rundown, what are your likes of this episode? Like, what are the pros? Okay.
I like that Peter Capaldi has a different approach on the Doctor. I like the way they handle Clara. I like Jean-Louis Coleman in this. Or I guess Jenna Coleman now. She's trying to drop the Louise part for some reason.
Julie Louise Coleman?
I was thinking the same thing. But I like the throwbacks to The Girl in the Fireplace. I like that they made the episode a metaphor for there being a new Doctor and not really quite sure. And they're not sure how to feel about this. And I like the optimism of the ending of, okay, let's see how you do.
Mm-hmm.
And I like how this is a doctor who is obviously, right from the get-go, it's not in key scenes he's scared. He feels scared the entire time. What I don't like is, I don't like how the plot really doesn't start until halfway through. I don't like weird out-of-character scenes. I don't like the dark tone that doesn't really feel like it belongs in this show. And it's all stuff where if they had it be something where they made their way through it gradually, or if it was just more minor scenes, then I'd be more okay with it. But as it stands, I'm not quite digging it at this point. And it's not enough for me to write off the show. I'm still definitely going to watch this next season. And I'm really excited about this next season. But I'm wondering where it's going.
Which can be seen as a good thing.
Yeah. Oh, I'm cautiously optimistic.
Okay. What would you give this rating? Like, what would be your rating of this?
Probably C+.
Okay. I agree in a lot of the pros. As I said, I love the analogy going on. I like the parallels between the half-faced man and the doctor. I like, for the most part, Peter Capaldi. I see a lot of potential in his performance, and I know he has the acting chops for it. I just hope that the writing improves a little bit, and we get more of a distinct character with him, which I think would be in the cons column. Jenna Louise Coleman is great in this. I think she's written pretty great. I like the aspects of the villain, even though I think they're a little underused. I agree on the weird change of character, like out of character moments. I do agree that it kind of the episode definitely didn't need to be as long as it was. It could definitely have been a 45-minute episode. And I'm still on the fence on Matt Smith's cameo. But I do like the ending a lot. I even find, you know, the whole scene with that Missy woman in heaven intriguing.
I'm interested, but I'm not sure what to make of that at this point.
Well, I mean, it's such a teaser and it's so vague that we can almost like really not even make any judgment on it. Yeah. I'm just kind of glad that we're kind of done with the silence and Trenzalore and all that. We're done with that, so we can kind of start a new arc. So hopefully deal with something completely different. And just the fact that Missy calls herself the doctor's girlfriend, when, you know, we have River, it's kind of like, this is intriguing. All right. I'm at least, my interest is at least piqued in this sense. So,
which is that, it just occurred to me. There's a scene in Forest of the Dead, the second half of the library episodes that Moffat wrote in season 4, and it's River's first episode, but she says something along the lines of, the last time I saw the doctor, he was in a wonderful top hat in a tuxedo or something like that, and he took me out dancing. I'm trying to figure out where that is in the timeline now.
And I don't even know if that's happened yet.
Yeah, well, I'm wondering if they're just going to ignore that now.
Maybe.
Because Matt Smith's gone completely. And without him, it would feel wrong to have River be interested in another doctor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I at least would like to see, what is her name? Is it Alex Kingston?
Yeah.
Yeah. I would definitely, I kind of miss her. I liked how she showed up in Angels of Manhattan, or Angels Take Manhattan, or whatever. Not the Daleks. Not the Daleks Take Manhattan. That should be the episode's name. And I liked her little appearance in The Name of the Doctor. But I do miss River. I know I'm like, I guess I'm kind of in the minority that I like River a lot. I actually would be interested to see how she interacts with Peter Capaldi. That would be kind of an interesting scene. I guess I agree, like, I don't know if I'd want them to be flirty and weird. Like, it'd be just kind of funny because Peter Capaldi's doctor could just be the weird, awkward one that doesn't notice flirting.
Yeah, which is honestly how they should do it. Or if he tries to flirt, it just comes off as creepy.
Yeah, something like that. and I'm actually pretty excited for what's going to happen. I like to think that I have, I have faith in Stephen Moffat. I'm not going to say that he is flawless by any means. I know there's a lot of people that hate him. And in some regards, I guess I understand it. But I would take Stephen Moffat over Russell T. Davies any day. Mm-hmm. But yeah, let's see where this goes. If I had to rate it, I'd probably give it a 7 out of 10. But like, I guess an enthusiastic one. I don't know. I don't know how to describe it. 7 out of 10, but it's good. You know, whatever. So, yeah.
You're more optimistic than me.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm just like, oh, this is going to be so awesome. You know, it definitely has its problems that needs to be addressed. And hopefully they are addressed properly. So,
ears open.
Ears open. So, that ends our Doctor Who recap for Deep Breath. I guess we'll be back next week.
I didn't breathe the entire time.
Oh, wow, Casey. You're a ventriloquist.
No, I exhaled. I never inhaled.
Oh.
To be fair, it might not count because I actually cut a hole into my lung and put a puck in there, and that's just like hooked it up to a balloon and was just deflating that into it.
You're like a Pez dispenser. But that ends our coverage of Deep Breath. I guess if you're listening, tell us your thoughts on the episode down in the comments. And I look forward to Into Within Without You, the Daleks. Mm-hmm. Yes. All right.
Join us next. George Harrison reference, I think. I don't know. It's late.
It's late. It kind of was. Okay. Join us in the next segment where we'll talk about the season 3 finale of The Legend of Korra. The show. I'm your host Taylor. Once again, I'm joined by Chris.
Boom clap, y'all. I don't know.
Okay.
It's me. We apparently love The Fault in Our Stars, even though none of us has seen it.
No, we just saw funny posts where they repeated the same two fucking frames over and over again.
Okay. People will totally get this just based on us talking about it. Inside jokes.
Inside jokes, you guys. Yeah, okay. Great.
Casey's also here.
What I wish happened? I wish we lived in a world where the Ramones did the theme song to every Stephen King movie.
Anyway, we're here to talk about Korra.
How many Stephen King movies have their own theme song with lyrics? I just want to know that, because I know you probably know that.
I think it's just the one, Chris. Either way, imagine...
Which one?
Pet Sematary.
Oh.
Okay, so, Korra. We're talking about the season 3 finale of The Legend
Which
of Korra.
Which doesn't have a theme song with lyrics.
That's perfectly fine. As long as we're talking about Korra.
Because we didn't talk enough about Korra the first time.
Well, we didn't cover the finale. Yeah, this is a great Crossroads episode, because one show begins as another ends.
Mm-hmm. It's like thematic like that shit, man.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, we'll just dive right into it. So, last we left... where did we leave Korra? Basically, we last left off with the Earth Queen getting killed, and SpongeBob laughed. I hope everyone has seen that.
Oh, is it because Tom Kenny played that little dude?
No.
No, dude, you didn't see that gif where, during the broadcast of that episode, a little thing for, and a little advert for SpongeBob coming up next showed up right when she was getting murdered, and he laughed.
Sounds like a Sin City narration. The Earth Queen dies. SpongeBob laughs. Fair trade.
And all the whores and politicians will shout
out. That's Watchmen, you dingus.
And Patrick Starr will whisper down, no.
Okay, so when I looked for it, I got a girl's face photoshopped onto SpongeBob.
Well, you looked it up wrong. Anyway, so the Earth Kingdom is in shambles, correct?
Bum, bum, bum.
Bum, bum, bum. Asami and Korra are in that little, oasis place, right?
Yeah, they're... They're at the crummy hotel that kind of actually sort of looks like any spa hotel that you see on TV.
No, that happened before.
It's like Sands Casino Hotel Resort.
They're with Korra's dad, Chief Beifong, and
Decrepit Zuko.
And Decrepit Zuko.
Crusty-ass Zuko.
So basically, what is the majority? Who wants to fill us in on... was it Into the Void or Enter the Void?
Enter the Void.
Enter the Void, yes.
Yeah, because it wasn't the really, really fucked up movie called Into the Void.
Followed by, what was it? Poison of the Red Lotus?
Yeah, Poison of the Red Lotus.
All right. So, so the thing is, Henry Rollins, he makes a...
Means Zaheer, don't make this confusing.
Yeah, Henry Rollins, he made fun of Robin Williams dying.
Art Garfunkel.
Oh my god, guys, this is so fucking confusing. Zaheer, the bad guy.
Zaheer, the antagonist, if you will, kidnaps all the airbenders and gives Korra an ultimatum. She can either go turn herself in, or he will kill all the airbenders. And after having a conversation with Zuko, because apparently he knew Aang better than anyone else, which just makes you think, isn't Katara still alive?
Yeah, and but he doesn't know where the fuck she is.
She's at the Northern Air Temple.
Casey, don't worry about it. Just Tenzin.
or Korra. She decides that she's going to turn herself in. But they try to set a trap so that after he frees all of the airbenders, she can then be rescued by Chief Beifon and friends. But the thing is, the moment she turns herself in, she's put in platinum shackles, and because apparently they have a platinum card, and then they're about to free the airbenders, but they realize, oh shit, all the airbenders are just fucking water this whole time!
Dun-dun-dun-dun!
And which leads to a really fucking awesome fight scene.
Yeah.
Holy shit, that fight scene's fucking incredible.
Which one are we talking about? The one between Zaheer and Tenzin?
The one between Zaheer and Korra and Korra's dad.
Well, we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit here.
Yeah. That's right after the prisoner exchange.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, because that's the
tough part about talking about this, because they all bleed together. But anyway, go on. Continue, Casey.
And so Korra needs to fight Zaheer off with the help of her dad, who is not as strong a bender as either of them. So he can't do as much. But Korra is also in shackles. So just seeing what she has to do, how she manages, is really fucking great. The fight choreography is incredible. And everything about it is super suspenseful. At the same time, Mako and Bolin have rescued Tenzin and are trying to find their way out. But fucking lava keeps being bent around them. So on one hand, you have a really awesome escape going on. On the other hand, you have a really awesome fight. And it just led to...
Well, I don't think lava's being bent around them. It's just that lava's just going to engulf the entire Northern Air Temple, right?
Well, the guy makes lava.
Because it's being bent.
Yeah, Kazan bent lava, and then it's just melting everywhere.
So it's being bent around them!
No, he stopped the bending.
This is such a... Okay. Bolin stops the bending, and that's how they escape. Is that what you're trying to say? Okay. Yeah,
well, especially the coolest part is when Bolin actually bends lava back.
Yeah, well, we learned that he can lava bend, too.
Yeah, he can lava bend. Metal bending's too highbrow for him, but lava bending, that's right up his alley.
Mm-hmm.
That's a right level of bending.
Can we also talk about Plea's death?
Oh, that was brutal.
I know, okay, so...
I was about to blast death metal and just bang my head.
For people who don't know or don't remember, Plea is Zaheer's girlfriend who has the combustion eye, and that's her firebending powers. That using her mind, she can create combustion and explosions. Yep. And so she's fighting both Beifongs, both of Toph's daughters. What's Chief Beifong's sister's
name? Su Yin.
Yeah, Su Yin. So it's Chief and Su Yin fighting her, as well as other metalbenders. And I think what I like about this whole episode is that everyone's doing something.
Yep. Doing something, but it's all organic. It's not like they're trying to crowbar in something for everybody.
Yeah, but I would argue that in previous seasons, one of the problems was, like, some characters would have to kind of sit out, you know, and not really have much to do. But that's what I like about the season as a whole, and I feel like Enter the Void is kind of the epitome of that, is that everything, like you said, is organic. Everything is working towards the story, and everyone is doing something proactive.
Yeah, because that's the thing. Climaxes can be really difficult because you have to find a fine line if you have more than one central character, in that they all have to have something to do that forwards a climax, but they also, if you also can't just say, oh, now Shia LaBeouf is fencing. Like, that was so fucking crowbarred in.
Shia LaBeouf is fencing.
Crystal Skull?
Oh, yes, okay.
Oh, no.
You had to remind me of Crystal Skull.
I mean Holes. Holes.
Oh, Holes. Wait, what?
Part where he has the fence yells.
What I think is more crowbarred in is how much fencing knowledge his mom has in that scene.
I think it's the simple fact that they have to do fencing where they're doing fencing just simply because they realize, Indy can't do everything in the climax. Because storytelling. But either way, what I'm getting at is that they do everything. They find something for everybody to do, even just tertiary airbender characters.
Yeah, like,
And a lot of stuff, there's a lot of payoffs in this finale, too.
Which is the best.
I thought Kai was dead, not gonna lie.
Yeah, but it's like, it's nice that Kai actually finally gets to do something, because he's one of those characters, he's probably the biggest example of a character that doesn't get to do much, along with the other airbenders, really, but I'm glad that
they're novices.
Well, I know.
And if they were to actually, like, full-on confront them, they'd all be dead.
Well, I'm just saying, Chris.
And
I'm
yet,
saying from
somehow,
a,
that finale.
I'm saying from a storytelling standpoint, at least in the end, they make it so it makes sense and they're able to all do something. So
yeah.
Anyway, continue with what you're saying, Casey.
So let's see. Back to the plot.
Wait. I guess we should mention again, because I brought it up. I might as well mention it. The way Plea dies, where Soon Yin is able to
piece of metal around her head.
Yeah, she wraps a metal piece of metal around her head, basically encasing her head in metal, just as she's about to
combust.
Yes, and basically blows her head up, but they don't
and
show
her
it.
Head bursts into jelly.
Well, don't say it like that. It makes it sound like they actually show it, but they don't.
I'm imagining just if you go inside, there's a lot like Last Shot of the Fly.
It is exactly like they just put that footage in. They don't even fucking
just
try.
Even better, just like crudely photoshopped it over her head.
Sure,
be great.
But so, please, dead, and that was, I think, in Enter the Void, that was the one part where I was just like, oh my god, like. Cause just
oh my god! Did the good guy just kill the bad guy? Like, that's legitimately actually a thing. Like,
what's wrong with your face?
Oh, you don't have one anymore. And another thing I like about Enter the Void is that it's so fucking tense. Like, basically, the entire time. I don't know about you guys, but did you feel like someone was gonna die?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I felt like more like I thought they were gonna die.
The good guys have a body count to them, then you genuinely feel that somebody on the good side could die.
And wasn't that your complaint like a couple seasons ago or something?
Whose complaint?
They weren't getting there's no sacrifice or
no. My issue isn't that somebody needed to die with season one. My issue is when Korra is just able to undo everything that happened in the season, it means that there's less tension. It's like if you find out that something was all a dream and nobody was in any danger all along. It's like, oh, if you can reverse that, because taking away their bending was their equivalent of having a death in that show. When they couldn't actually kill somebody off, they had somebody... they had somebody lose their bending. That is how they are out of commission and can't do much. It would have had a lot more of an effect to say, after Chief Beifong loses her bending, she now has to stay police chief without her bending, and she's still fucking awesome. That would be great.
Well, like, a big problem of the earlier seasons of Korra is just a lack of consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's kind of refreshing about, obviously this season, as we'll get to. But kind of the second half of season two, where, I think as it goes along, since It's kind of odd that this is going to be a four-season show, especially when it has such a, like, trilogy feel to it. Like, I've... Because we'll just say right now, like, we'll keep it vague for now, but would you say that this has, like, the middle part of a trilogy, like, yes, dark ending? Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
It feels, yeah, like, the more as the show goes on, it feels...
Your main character is at their low points.
Yeah.
This is where they should be before you bring them into the third act.
And it's interesting looking at the show from this aspect because it feels like season one is more or less just like, here's a season because, you know, they only wanted it to really be a mini series from the get-go. Mm-hmm.
Here's a new look at a new avatar. Like,
it's just like, it's more of an exercise in just world building and just kind of introducing characters and playing around with them. But then season two and now season three and probably season four are going to be its own trilogy with like this ongoing story about, you know, the merging of the human world and the spirit world. We already saw one of the repercussions of that with the Return of the Airbenders. And just random people getting airbenders, and it definitely feels like this is just going to continue into season four, which you know, I know earlier, like Casey and we talked about it last time about how in the very beginning of the season they introduce like, you know, these ideas about, you know, the spirit world appearing in our world and causing problems, and that's kind of dropped once the whole idea of airbenders comes back. And
because that has bigger priorities.
Well, I feel like that's going to play a much bigger role in season four.
I hope it does.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to feel like it's just a big, you know, it's going to feel like they dropped the ball if they don't address it at all. But I feel like that would be a great way to deal with what happens to Korra at the end and kind of her being in the state she's in and having to deal with the continual problems of the spirits now in the real world.
But can we talk about how she ended up getting into the state she's in? Because, oh my God, that was amazing.
Yeah, we can get into, poison. Is it Venom? Venom of the Red Lotus is the actual name of the finale.
She's captured by Jafar.
And Zaheer, not Zaheer. Jafar. Jesus Christ, Casey.
Dude, at work with Jafar, Zaheer.
Zah-fucking-here.
But wait.
I said Zahar, not
the
Jafar.
The moment when he achieves weightlessness, I kind of just fucking freaked out and hit under my bed. That was nuts.
Well, I think when his girlfriend dies,
please,
that is the thing that... And that drives him over the edge. And as he puts it, he lost worldly temptations and worldly possessions. He has nothing else here.
Just let go your earthly tethers.
At that moment, he truly let go. And now he can fucking fly.
He basically just becomes fucking Superman.
Yeah. Yep.
It's a lot like that SpongeBob episode where he lets go of his worldly possessions and then he can fly. Isn't that what happens in that episode?
I think it was Band Geeks.
SpongeBob and Legend of Korra just blend together in my brain.
Yep. But
just like there's less than two stupid dogs for me.
Basically where we start Venom of the Red Lotus is that there's this like it's not really underground, but it's in the mountains, this mountainous, cavernous headquarters of the Red Lotus where
hidden behind an old air nomad monument.
Yes. And Korra is basically chained up above lava, and they're going to use this poison, which I think uses platinum, doesn't it?
Yep.
Yes.
And her chains are platinum, so she can't bend out of them.
But there's also platinum in the stuff. It's made out of metal, the poison.
Yeah.
And because basically what they're going to do is they're going to make this poison go in through her skin and basically kill her from the inside, which makes her avatar state come out in order to, you know, protect herself, and then they're gonna just kill her when she's in the avatar state, because when you're killed in the avatar state, then the avatar line is dead, it's gone. And I think it's, and they use this as a great way to develop Korra's character, Because as she's being, as the poison is inside her, she's basically just fighting to stay alive and to control her avatar state.
Yeah, well, she tried to, at that point, the thing I like about it is, to a degree, she's not even trying to stay alive, she's just trying to stay out of the avatar state. Because if she dies without the avatar state, then there's nothing that, then at least there will be another avatar.
Yeah. And while she's going through this, it's actually a really great, like, spooky scene where mm-hmm. we're seeing from her perspective as, I believe it's...
Ming-Hwa.
Ming-Hwa, Zaheer, and Gazan. Gazan. And basically she's looking at them, and their faces are morphing into previous bad guys, which are Amon... Is it Tarlok?
Tarlok,
and...
Sarlacc-Pit.
Unalaq.
And Unalaq, the giant evil kite.
No, it's Unalaq and Vatu. What the fuck am I saying?
Yeah, Vatu, the evil.
Now you're just listing Bionicles.
The evil.
That's what I was gonna say. I'm like, dude, I'm about to just start straight up listing Bionicles.
Vatu.
So while they're on the island of Matanui,
as Vatu, the evil demon kite, shows up.
For the benefit of Mr. Demon Kite, there will be a show tonight.
There you go. You're welcome, Casey. And I think this is just... I think it makes it great... I like how it connects to the previous seasons. You know, like... I don't know how to describe it. I don't want to make it sound like Avatar The Last Airbender has very... obviously, they don't have disconnected seasons. It's one story going through. But...
There's some standalones.
In what?
In Last Airbender.
Well, yes and no. I wouldn't say they're necessarily standalone because, I mean, they have a greater goal.
Like, yeah,
most episodes of The Last Airbender do end up becoming a big thing later on.
The Ember Island players?
There's exceptions not to this rule, of course. But most episodes at least get one callback going on. Like something like, say, Jets seems like a standalone episode that's not going to have a factor. Then it comes back in a big way. Or the Kyoshi Warriors. Obviously, it's more so with those than, say, whatever the fuck that Valley episode was.
Oh, yeah, fuck that one. Well, that's because Book 1, Water, is just... it's basically just introducing the players. It's basically like kind of the first season of Korra. They're very similar in a way, because they're just kind of introducing these themes.
Yep.
A general theme of the more political aspects of Korra, which come into play throughout pretty much every other, you know, every subsequent season, so. But Korra actually enters the Avatar state, but before they can actually kill her, she goes fucking insanely... She goes insane and frees herself and kicks some fucking ass.
Which I gotta say, one of my favorite parts of that is when it's just simply the odd angles they choose to draw her at and how they show her. It just feels so disorientating. Just seeing like a full frontal face instead of a three quarters. And it looks like something out of a lesser Yu-Gi-Oh! Episode.
Which shots are you talking about?
Like, say, when she has her eyes really wide.
Oh, that one. And
just looking right at her face. It's not from the side or anything. So no profiles, no three-quarter shots.
Yeah, it's a high-angle down shot.
Yeah.
On her face, right? Yeah, when she's hallucinating. Yeah.
Yeah, which is how they... One of their... For you Yu-Gi-Oh! Fans out there, I'm sorry that you're Yu-Gi-Oh! fans.
Yeah.
But Merrick, whenever... That was one of their stock animations for him when he was completely wacko, is high angle, full frontal face.
Mm-hmm.
Eyes wide shut, full metal jacket.
Eyes wide shut, yes. The Shining!
Paths of Glory!
But Barry, I guess now we can... Now we can move into the fucking fantastic fight scene between Zaheer and Korra. Which is just... It's such a great grand scale fight.
And it didn't do all those Man of Steel, like, throw them all the way up and then slam them down moves, which I thought could have happened. Like,
well, they do similar stuff to it.
Weightless.
They do similar stuff to it. But I mean, I guess there's going to be Man of Steel parallels, even though this takes place in the middle of the fucking mountains.
And I didn't get any Man of Steel parallels because I try not to think of Man of Steel, and I do like thinking of Legend of Korra.
Anyway, so I just love the animation in this fight scene. How much the camera actually moves is fantastic. I love the bit where Korra's just flying around, where she's basically using, like, propulsion from firebending to fly. And she still has her chains, and she's using those as weapons. And she's... Zaheer's flying around a mountain, and she's following him, bending the mountain in half to lift up and murder him. Because, like, most of her motivation, like, obviously she wants to defeat him, but she thinks that her dad's dead at this point. And I was actually honestly thinking that he was going to die in Enter the Void, too, but he's saved by that one chick that they have weird foreshadowing with. But yeah, I mean, what else can we say about this fight other than it's fucking fantastic?
And we get it's another case of giving everybody something to do in that fight.
Yeah, because the airbenders they're a key part of beating Zaheer in this.
Yeah. Because I think them together create a fucking hurricane.
Tornado.
Sharknado.
Coronado. Coronado.
Coronation.
Wink.
Why hasn't the Korra fan base been called a Coronation yet?
That's what they're called.
Oh, is it?
They're called Coronation.
Oh. Wow.
Casey.
Wow.
Pat. Anyway.
Fuck this. I'm going to go watch Peter Jackson's King Kong. I'll see you guys in 9 hours.
Okay.
Just kidding. You know, that's why it took him 4 years to make another movie after Kong. They were still at the premiere until 2009.
Oh.
Anyway.
It's funny because the movie's long.
As the battle between Korra and Zaheer continue on, Korra still has the poison inside her, and despite her best efforts, it's still, you know, bringing her down and slowly killing her. And eventually it just becomes too much and she crashes down where everyone is. And but not until after she slams Zaheer right into the ground and everybody captures him in rocks. Yep. And so he is defeated.
No.
What?
The air.
We already said that about the tornado.
Oh, the air tornado?
Yes.
Yes, a minute ago.
Oh man, I'm getting tired.
It shows. And we believe that Korra's dead. Her dad is cradling her in her arms. And basically, you know, they decide... it's really... This is where, like, the metal bender part of the story actually, you know, comes to fruition, I guess, or pays off. Because it's... Sunyin is the one that is able... Because it's platinum, I guess, she's able to just... Bend.
No, they can't bend platinum. It's just that there's metal in it.
Okay, yeah, so there's metal.
He's right.
Okay, so there's metal in it. Whatever. That's confusing. It's like her
it's
shackles
like
platinum
are. Platinum is the. What's that Star Wars metal that you can't hit a lightsaber with? It's not
no
Frick.
I don't know.
Whatever.
But anyway, Sunyin's able to get the poison out. That isn't made out of platinum, but just metal, I guess. And. Then we cut to, what, 2 weeks later? And, like, when we last, in the previous scene, we're just like, oh, okay, she's tired, she's safe, that's fine. And then we learn Korra has been basically rendered paraplegic. Yeah, she's crippled. She's basically a paraplegic in a wheelchair.
She's crippled.
And, is basically still feeling the effects of the poison. She has bags under her eyes. She's exhausted still. And it's a fucking downer.
Yeah, we see her physically and mentally drained more than we've actually seen a character in the show as of yet.
Well, I think, and part of that, I'm sure, is because when she, in her fight against Zaheer, this is pretty much the most, like, balls to the wall we've ever seen an Avatar go. As far as I remember. Really.
Yep, no, I would say this is the most reckless and ruthless fight that they've ever had.
Not even... I thought the last one she was in with the Dark Avatar was pretty
up there. But then again, it was because it was for the fate of the world rather than the fate of one nation.
And that one, but I guess the reason why I see that one as different is because that's her and what's the name of the good, the spirit of light?
Rava.
Yeah, because she fuses with Rava in that, right?
Also Pacific Rim.
Yeah.
So she fuses with Rava in that fight. So it's not really necessarily just Korra fighting against the Dark Avatar.
Yeah, but the thing is, because of that, even though it's still a personal story, it's not as personal as, say, this.
Yeah, that's
this
what I'm
saying. This season is really great at having it be smaller, more down to earth. And this one, even though they get into a lot of the political stuff and having nations be overturned and all that, when you get down to it, the fight isn't between big armies or anything. It's between this one guy and this other, and this one girl, and a few extra people that they know.
Well, I liked a description I heard about Zaheer and his gang in that they're not really like they're really just assholes that want to kill all the
leaders.
They're
really just punks, man.
Yeah, like, they're just punk rockers. And they're assholes, and it's just kind of amazing.
There was one night where they said, "Hey, you want to form a punk band, or you want to try to overthrow the government?" And they went with the latter.
And it's
they
like,
they could have been the Clash of this fucking universe.
They could have been the Black Flag. Let's get our.
They could have been the Kinks if they wanted to.
No,
they
you know been, why I say Black Flag, right?
They were basically the people that the kid that killed Franz Ferdinand. Basically.
I thank you for that reference.
You're welcome for that reference, because it's fucking true.
Yep.
They're just schmutz that killed a monarch. And it's like, another thing I've read, and people review this, is that the comparison of Aang to Korra, and Aang was a person that he had, like, kind of the emotional aspects of it. Yeah, he was a kid, but, like, he understood through his airbender training about peace and helping and all that stuff and how to be humble.
And how to be carefree.
Well, whatever, but about his whole arc is about learning to the techniques of being an avatar, how to, you know, how to bend. That's why every book is about him learning a new type of bending. Mm-hmm. Korra's is the exact opposite. She has all the techniques. That's why we start in season one, where she's really proficient in everything but airbending. She already knows all three out of the four forms of bending.
Mm-hmm.
And but she doesn't have the emotional maturity, you know, to really truly be the avatar. And that's where I give these writers a lot of credit, and a lot of credit to her character, and why I think Korra should really be considered a great avatar compared, like, alongside Aang.
Mm-hmm.
Because the fuck she goes through, because when you look at the timetable of the three seasons so far, they're probably within like a year of each other.
I would say a year and a half at the very most.
Yeah, I think at one point it's like there's like 7 months between seasons one and two, and then there can't be more than like a week between two and three.
Yeah, it was only a couple weeks.
So it's like a year, essentially. Yeah.
In fact, just think about that.
No, that's less.
After she nearly dies, almost a she nearly dies at the end of this season, and a month ago she was part god.
She's lost her bending. She's had to deal with, like, I guess, kind of the duality of her people. You know,
she's had to deal with the duality of her people. She's had to deal with her own family turning against her. She's had to deal with the public not thinking highly of her. She, like, Korra's life has been an uphill battle since she became the Avatar.
And now she's basically been rendered, I'm sure in her mind, as useless, because she's lost her mobility, she's lost her bending, she's lost most of her strength, and she's just relegated to a wheelchair. So, you know, I could see why she's depressed, because it's about the whole thing about, you know, bending is her life to her.
You know how I could actually genuinely, legitimately see the season four premiere going? They're on an airship, and it crashes for some reason, and everything's in chaos, but she just stands up and can suddenly walk again.
My God, no. Please don't have some, like, oh man, I can miraculously walk, you know, without proper.
No, but then people keep telling her what she can't do, and she'll find a hatch.
Oh my God, shut up, Casey.
Going there.
Actually, I was thinking
I legitimately think I'm pretty sure this is actual truth. The writers of Avatar are actually really big fans of Lost.
Oh, so that's I'm why sure. there's a polar bear dog?
Well, not only just a polar bear dog, but if you look at even musically, if you listen to it, it sounds very Michael Giacchino-esque. And they have certain cues and sound effects that sound like they're out of Lost. I'm positive that's intentional, and I really, or at least I really hope they are, because I like to think that other people are Lost fans.
Okay, so let's wrap this up. Finally, you know, 2 weeks later, Korra's in a wheelchair, and in like one of the biggest like condescending things ever, you have like, was it the president of Republic City? He's like, "You're welcome back in the city," and it's like, "Well, fucking thank you." You remember that scene?
I do.
Yes. Okay.
And I was just thinking all that time. You know, she needs business cards to just say, "You're welcome" at this point.
Yeah, you're fucking welcome, bitch. I'm the Avatar, bitch. Mark Zuckerberg. Anyway, so in this last scene, she's going to it's the Air Temple, right? Outside of Republic City.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. To view the ceremony for Jinora, the eldest daughter of Tenzin, to become an airbending master and essentially look just like Aang. And it's amazing. It's a great cap to the airbending storyline that's had its fair share of, you know, ups and downs throughout the season. But I think this scene makes it all worth it. And it's a beautifully done scene. It gave me goosebumps. I don't know about you guys. Because it was just interesting to see basically Aang again, Kid Aang. Mm-hmm. And then, of course,
that's what I was thinking. It's like, oh, it's Aang, but you'll grow tits one day.
Oh, thanks, Casey.
Well, at first it looks a little too much like Aang, and then when she stands up, you actually, okay, there's enough differences. So it's a very nice way of both giving you that throwback and making her separate and of herself.
Well, yeah, I mean, literally, she doesn't even talk during the scene, does she?
Nope.
Okay, I mean,
she hugs her daddy.
Yeah, so.
And her dad seems pretty okay that she's a skinhead.
I'm sure, God damn it, Casey. I'm sure once she starts talking, it's going to be fine, because she's voiced by Sally Draper, so there you go. And then we just end with Korra crying. One single tear, and it's like the saddest, most soul-crushing thing ever.
Much like Battle for the Planet of the Apes and the Statue of Caesar.
Don't you fucking dare. Don't ruin this.
I thought of Battle for the Planet of the Apes. In my defense, fuck Battle for the Planet of the Apes.
Alright, so there you go. That's the recap of the finale of Season 3 of Korra. Let's go around and give our final thoughts on the season. Chris, do you want to go first? Chris? Casey?
Hi, I'm the Caser, and I thought that this episode was pretty fucking fantastic. People have been giving shit to The Legend of Korra that it does not deserve, and this solidifies it for me. I prefer Legend of Korra to The Last Airbender.
Okay.
I really, really, really love how it handles the Avatar as an older character. It's a character who is much more... it's a character who has to deal with a lot more stuff, a lot more of the turmoil of growing up. Because Aang is a lot more mature, and it's giving the Avatar power to somebody who's not necessarily mature enough to handle them and making her grow. We've seen Korra change so much in 3 seasons, and this solidifies it, especially in that last part, where she is fucking broken. She is so broken she could be a character in The Leftovers at this point.
Or The Wire, you know, whatever. Pick your poison.
Hey, if you walk through the garden, you better watch your back.
I agree. I definitely think this is the best season by far. Yeah. It's the most consistent. And even problems that Casey may have had, I may not have had, like, with the metal benders and stuff. I still enjoyed that stuff.
I enjoyed it, too. I just felt like it could have been shorter. But at this point, as you get to the end of the season, a lot more of the reasons that they focus on certain things become clear. Like, the metal bending comes back in a really big way as the season wraps up.
Yeah, and then you can kind of understand why they spent so much time with them, I guess. Even if, you know, they may not have needed to spend as much time with them as they did. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. I'm still so mixed on it because I still think that Avatar The Last Airbender is a much more consistent show. But I will definitely say that Korra is a more adventurous show in the kind of territory it's willing to tackle. And while it does have hills and valleys in the quality of the show, and there are times where it feels like it may have like either meander a little bit, some characters kind of get left in the dark for a bit. Of course, you have the lack of consequences in the first two seasons for a little bit. Well, obviously with the first season, with that ending, and a bit with the second season, but I like watching Korra grow into the show it should be.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the most gratifying thing about watching the show, is that you see a show that has so much potential, and while it would have been great if it met that potential in the very beginning and just been consistent throughout, it has this old kind of whole other great feeling to it to watch the show go like kind of be the underdog,
mm-hmm.
in a sense, and then rise to its potential and just be fucking awesome.
And I am reminded, if I can make one more Lost analogy, I am reminded of...
No, Casey, you can't.
Well, too bad.
500 is too many. What am I kidding? It's like 10,000.
But I'm very, very... Season 2 of Lost is not a good season. It's a really mediocre season. And then Season 3 is... starts off same way, but then it starts getting better. They start killing off characters you don't need. They start giving more reasons for you to be watching it. And then finally, by the time you get to the last quarter of Season 3, oh my god, that is a giant you're welcome to everybody who stayed on board.
Yeah.
Okay, Chris. Do you want to give your thoughts on Korra?
Well, I don't know. This is definitely a more personal season. It definitely was a different vibe going on as compared to the last one, which is just like, oh my god, we're gonna go full Miyazaki or bust. Get ready for all your anime loves. And I kind of dug it a little more, to be honest. You know, kind of turning you on your head with making an airbender a villain. I thought that was a cool idea that they really ran with. And
because
a really great performance out of Henry Rollins, who's just like the most dedicated fucker out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I do love how with this show, the villains have all been benders that have never really been villains. You know, waterbenders and airbenders, basically. Mm-hmm. Aang and Katara.
Yep. Well, no, because the Firebenders became fucking Slytherin for a while. It was just like, they're evil by default.
Yeah,
Nazis and Germans.
Yeah, and Season 2 of Last Airbender saw plenty of, you know, Earthbenders be dicks, so...
Yeah, like the Lao Gaians.
Yeah, and...
Or Dai Li agents.
I just feel like the writing's tighter... The relationships are better. I love, like, I know we mentioned last time when we talked about Korra, Asami and Korra. Fucking
friendships.
Yes, is fucking awesome. I'm so supporting that friendship.
No, dude, I love how they became gal pals.
Yeah, it's because it's like, that's the thing, is that the relationship between, like, Team Avatar this season kind of makes all of the petty romance stuff in the first two seasons just seem like that much more what the fuck, except in Season 2, I guess, to develop Korra. That's really, like, the only thing it really amounted to. So at least it amounted to something, but...
Yeah. But I do really love, like, throughout the season, her closest friend has been Asami.
Yeah, and in the fucking finale, like, the second to last scene or so.
Yeah.
Where she helps her get dressed.
Yeah, they're fucking gal pals at that point, and oh my god. It's really great. I love their friendship. And one of my favorite scenes is when she hugs Team Avatar. Her closest one is with Asami, and then there's one where there's affection between her and Mako, but they've moved beyond that. And then the one with Bolin, where it's like, it's clear she's driving him up a wall, but she still loves him to pieces.
Yeah.
I fucking love that, that scene.
Yeah. And I like the stuff that they gave Mako and Bolin to do, developing. Like, they really utilize the fact that they're in the Earth Kingdom.
Yeah, they utilize the fact that they're in the Earth Kingdom, and they utilize the fact that they're brothers and meeting their family and all that.
Yes, so what would you give as a rating to the whole season?
A-.
A-, so 9 out of 10. Chris, what would you...
Out of our new arbitrary rule system, because that's what this website operates on, I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10 red pandas, or red panda ferrets.
Yeah, I give it 11 Pabus out of 4. Go fucking watch it.
Yeah, I would probably give it 9 of M. Night Shyamalan's fingers cut off and sent to various media sources out of 10.
Yeah, that's another good arbitrary rating.
Oh. Yeah, go
dude,
watch
arbitrary
it.
Arbitrary ratings are pretty great.
Yes, if you haven't watched the season yet, go catch up on it. I think all of it's on nick.com. So
yeah, and I think this Friday they're actually advertising you can watch the entire series on streaming there in order.
No, even I think I got an email that was like, you can watch the entire show online.
That's it. They're making a point. It's like, oh, are they going to be showing them all online in order, streaming? You can do that on your own.
Yeah, that's in so fact, weird. Probably the only thing I'd give a downgrade to on the show is just, like, when they're, like, pulled the plug from airing it live, I kind of was just, like, forced to watch it on my phone because I didn't have a bigger screen I could watch it on, and I'm kind of not the world's biggest fan of using my work computer to watch TV shows on, and...
But is that really
it go
a fault?
Super slow.
Is that really a fault of the show, or more?
Oh
just...
no, it's just a nitpick of how terrible the handling of.
Oh no, Nickelodeon for handling this awfully.
Yeah. It's such a weird, like, sad, like, ironic fact that
because it's like I would say it's their best show, and I'm pretty sure you guys would agree with me on that, right?
Like, I mean, it's really the only show I give a shit about.
I like the one with the guy and the snake. Thank you very much. No.
Sanjay and Craig.
I love the kid and the snake.
Yeah, Sanjay and Craig.
Sanjay and Craig.
Actually, I kind of have a soft spot for Sanjay and Craig, but
it's not bad.
God damn it.
But, like, honestly, like, I could take it or leave it. Korra's fucking awesome, and it's the only thing I'll actually, you know, invest in from Nickelodeon. And it's just a sad, ironic fact that, you know, it's the best season of the show, and they pull it from airing on TV and put it to online only.
I'm hoping that the next season they go back to airing on TV.
We'll have to see. I mean, as long as it gets the ratings it needs and is successful online or whatever, then so be it.
You watch the next season, it has actually already aired online. They just haven't told anybody.
We're going to air every episode in theaters. Like something stupid.
Tomorrow.
There's like a little like clicker at the bottom of Nickelodeon. It's like, BT Dubs Korra Season 4 premieres tomorrow at, we don't know yet, but it's probably going to be tomorrow. Be there or not, whatever.
We don't give a shit. We're Nickelodeon. We have Ninja Turtles coming out.
Book 3 of Korra.
Shit all over your children.
Book 3, Change. It lives up to its title.
It was definitely a change.
I think we should play the David Bowie song Changes at the end.
I did that last time.
I know, we should do it again.
No.
If we're quoting Shrek, then yes, I agree.
Anyway.
Is it in the Shrek movie? I don't know.
If you haven't seen Book 3 of Korra, go watch it, please. Tell us your thoughts in the comments about what you thought of the finale. And I guess we'll end this episode by saying what we say every week, right?
Have a good summer vacation.
Keep studying.
It's almost over.
Keep studying.
And then we're going to have to keep studying
again. Keep fucking studying, guys!
Keep studying!